Imagine having a brilliant product idea. You know, you are totally fired up, you've got this clear vision, and you are just ready to build.
Oh, that's the best phase, the honeymoon phase of a project.
Right, exactly. But instead of falling into what I like to call Figma purgatory, where you spend like 3 months drawing static mock-ups and obsessing over pixel-perfect layouts.
And arguing in a Slack channel about button padding, I know it well.
Yes. Instead of all that, you just bypass it. You build the actual working code, push it out to the live internet, and let the messy, unpredictable real world tell you if it actually solves the problem.
I mean, honestly, that is a terrifying proposition for anyone who has worked on a traditional product team.
Oh, absolutely.
We are so deeply conditioned by modern software development practices to believe that we must eliminate all uncertainty. Through wireframes, user testing, you know, endless stakeholder reviews.
Before you were ever allowed to write a single line of production code.
Exactly. It's like a rigid law.
But today's deep dive is exploring the product design process of a single person development team who completely inverted that traditional model.
Yeah, they just threw the playbook out the window.
They really did. We are looking at a scenario where mock-ups and prototypes actually become a severe bottleneck. And production quality code becomes the prototyping medium itself.
Right, resulting in a development lifecycle that is just incredibly fast.
Right, so fast that feedback doesn't come from some theoretical user testing session in a sterile conference room. It comes from the actual product being actively used in its native environment.
And to understand how this actually works, we are analyzing a really comprehensive stack of developer notes, architectural specs, and design reflections for a live application called GreenRidge.
Yeah, and to give you, the listener, the full physical context, we've also brought in the official recreation guidelines from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources.
Which is super important for grounding this whole thing.
Definitely. So our mission for you today is to uncover how bypassing those traditional prototypes for a rapid live code cycle allows a solo creator to get immediate reality-tested feedback.
And more importantly, how you can apply this kind of operational leverage to your own projects.
Okay, let's unpack this.
We really have to start with the physical constraints of the environment because, honestly, they dictate every single technical choice that follows.
Right. The real world gets a vote.
Exactly. So the developer, Chris Mullins, was trying to solve a problem at Green Ridge State Forest. And according to the Department of Natural Resources documentation, this forest has 100 designated primitive campsites.
Dispersed across this just massive area.
Right. And primitive is not a marketing term here. It literally means a picnic table, a metal fire ring, and that's it.
Zero plumbing.
Zero plumbing, super spotty cellular service, and a very strict leave no trace policy.
It's extremely rugged.
Yeah.
And, you know, it only costs $10 a night, which is great.
Right.
But the friction comes from how you actually get a site.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah, there is absolutely no digital reservation system, no centralized database, no API you can query to see what's open.
None of that. The sites are strictly first come, first served.
So if you want a place to sleep, you have to physically drive down to the forest headquarters, walk up to a literal bulletin board, and write your name with a pen on a paper clipboard.
So old school.
That single physical piece of paper is the absolute unquestionable source of truth.
Which presents this really fascinating product design paradox, right? How do you build a digital tool for a system that fundamentally refuses to be digitized?
That's a great question.
In the developer notes, Chris admits he initially fell into a very common trap. He built what he called a campsite browser.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it featured interactive maps, filtering systems, and this beautiful interface that tried to show users what campsites were supposedly available.
But the problem there is that he was building an interface that implicitly promised precision. By making it look like a modern booking system, the app was telling the user, hey, I know exactly what is available right this second.
Yeah, but since the actual availability lived on a literal piece of paper miles away in the woods, the app was essentially lying to its users.
It was faking a digital signal that simply didn't exist. It's like trying to build a live tracker for a neighborhood food truck that refuses to use GPS.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just draw a little dot on a digital map and pretend it's real time. You have to design around the reality of people just looking out their apartment windows and shouting, hey, the truck is on Fifth Street right now.
Yeah, you are crowdsourcing reality because you simply cannot automate it.
Exactly.
And what's fascinating here is that uncertainty isn't an edge case in this app. Uncertainty is the core product condition.
Wow, yeah.
The developer realized that in this specific domain, the freshness of the data matters infinitely more than fake precision.
Because telling a user, hey, this was the state of the physical board 2 hours ago, is infinitely more valuable, and honestly, intellectually honest, than saying, oh, Site 42 is definitely open.
Right, because that piece of paper is the only truth. So simulating the app's interface in a design tool became entirely pointless.
You just can't simulate a camper standing in a forest with terrible cell service, trying to read a screen through the glaring sun with cold hands.
No, you can't. You have to test ideas in the wild.
Which brings us to this whole concept of production code as the prototype.
Yes. Instead of trying to perfect the visual interface in some sterile sandbox environment, Chris pushed his experiment straight to live production code. He utilized tools like Vite and React to build out the front-end interfaces directly.
And the developer notes detail some of these early visual experiments, and they were incredibly elaborate.
Oh, yeah, over the top.
We're talking tilt-based parallax effects, where the background shifts as you move your phone, spatial imagery, and these dramatic cinematic hero sections for the campsite profiles.
It probably looked like an award-winning portfolio piece on a 27-inch desktop monitor.
Oh, for sure, but then he actually put it in the hands of users standing in the dirt.
And reality hits.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He quickly discovered that when you are in the field, you know, frantically trying to figure out if you have a place to set up your tent before the sun goes down, you don't care about cinematic motion design.
You care about speed, legibility, and saving your battery life.
Right. So his design refinement phase consisted entirely of deleting code. He stripped out the parallax, simplified the UI, and aggressively trimmed the text.
Now, I have to pause and push back on this a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
Deploying untested visual experiments straight to a live production environment breaks literally every rule of traditional quality assurance.
Well, yeah.
If you did that at a major tech company and broke the layout for thousands of users, you'd probably be fired. It sounds like a recipe for absolute chaos. Are we overprotecting our users from our design process?
Under traditional paradigms, you would be entirely correct. But we have to look at the scale and the feedback loop here. When your deployment loop is measured in hours rather than two-week agile sprints, a broken layout isn't a catastrophic crisis.
Right, it's just a temporary data point.
Let me give you a specific example from the code base regarding how a map loads. The original map screen used this highly complex loading shell.
Okay.
It had dwell timers, tile load gates, and these complicated fail-safes. The entire goal was a very designer-centric idea. Prevent the user from seeing the map tiles loading in awkwardly, ensuring this perfectly smooth visual transition.
Basically trying to make it feel like a polished native app.
Right. But what happens when that complex logic hits the unpredictability of a spotty 3G connection in the woods?
It completely breaks down.
Yep. Due to the interaction between the network delay and a development tool called React Strict Mode, which, for those who don't know, intentionally renders components twice to catch bugs, the loading shell would sometimes never dismiss.
Oh, no. So users were just stuck.
Yes. Users were left staring at an endless loading animation while the actual map data was sitting right there behind it, fully loaded.
So what did the developer do?
He ripped the entire complex shell out. Just deleted it. He replaced it with an eager loading leaflet container. And Leaflet is just an open source library that powers interactive maps.
Okay.
By making it eager loading, the app simply mounts the map immediately and shows a default view of the forest while the specific site data fetches in the background. He prioritized immediate ugly utility over fragile visual perfection.
So he was basically letting the cleanup be the design work.
Precisely. And there are these incredible micro adjustments happening on the fly, too.
Like what?
Well, if you've ever built a web application for an iPhone, you know the absolute headache of the iOS font zoom issue.
Oh, I hate that feature so much.
It's the worst. If you set an input field's font size to anything less than 16 pixels, Apple's operating system thinks the text is too small to read, so it automatically zooms the entire screen in when a user taps the input.
And it completely shatters your carefully planned layout.
Yep. The developer saw this happening in the live environment, went directly into the code, bumped the date inputs to 16 pixels, and just pushed the fix live immediately.
That's the beauty of live code.
He also noticed that the availability bar, which held the dates and action buttons like tonight, all cramped into a single flexible row, was simply too hard to hit with a thumb on a narrow mobile screen.
Especially if your hands are freezing.
Exactly. So he went into the CSS, moved the action buttons into a dedicated grid layout, and made them massive. He wasn't asking, does this look aesthetically pleasing? He was asking, can a tired camper wearing gloves actually tap this button?
And to maintain that incredible speed of iteration, where you spot a problem, fix the code, and push it live in an hour, you need an architecture that actually supports instantaneous updates.
Right, which is easy on the web.
Exactly. Iterating instantly works beautifully on the open web, where a user just refreshes their browser. But GreenRidge is fundamentally a field tool. It needs to live on people's mobile phones.
Which introduces a massive bottleneck. Because getting an app into the iOS App Store or Google Play Store usually means stepping into a bureaucratic nightmare of review cycles.
Oh, absolutely.
You submit an update to fix a button, and you wait 3 days for a reviewer to approve it. That completely kills the rapid prototyping loop we just talked about.
It stops it dead in its tracks.
So how does a solo developer keep the deployment speed of a website while still getting an icon onto a user's home screen?
Through a very deliberate and honestly somewhat rebellious architectural choice, instead of writing two completely separate code bases, you know, a Swift app for Apple and a Kotlin app for Android, the developer utilized a technology called Capacitor.
Capacitor, okay.
Think of Capacitor as a universal translator. It takes standard web code, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and wraps it in a native shell so the phone treats it like a real application.
But the brilliant part here is the specific way he used it.
Yeah.
Usually you bundle all your web files inside that app download, but this architecture uses a remote URL model.
Right.
So essentially, the App Store version is just an empty picture frame, and the developer is swapping out the painting on the server side. Does Apple actually let you get away with that if it acts like a real app offline?
That picture frame analogy is perfect. The app on the phone is basically a specialized, borderless browser tab securely locked to that one live web address.
And Apple's okay with this?
Well, to ensure Apple actually approves it, because they generally hate apps that are just websites, the developer implemented a service worker.
Oh, okay.
A service worker is a script that runs in the background of your browser, acting like a local traffic cop. It intercepts network requests and saves data locally.
Got it.
So when a camper loses cell service in the forest, the service worker serves up a cached version of the app, keeping it fully functional offline. Because it behaves like a robust native application, it passes the App Store review.
The operational leverage here is just staggering. When Chris pushes a UI update like fixing that 16-pixel font issue or tweaking the map loading logic, he deploys it to his own web server.
Yeah.
And instantly, without any intervention from Apple or Google, every single iOS and Android user sees the updated UI the very next time they open the app.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this strategy grants a single creator the discoverability and trust of an App Store presence while rigidly maintaining the deployment speed of a web app. You only ever need to submit a new version to the gatekeepers if you change core hardware permissions.
Like if you suddenly decide to add native push notifications or need deep access to the device's camera.
Exactly. For everyday features and bug fixes, you bypass the bottleneck entirely.
Okay, so we've established how he prototyped directly in code and creatively sidestepped the deployment bottlenecks. But let's ground this in reality for a second.
Sure.
Actually writing all of that front-end React code, setting up the back-end API, configuring the cloud infrastructure, the caching, the routing, doing all of that alone is a daunting, exhausting amount of work. It usually leads to total burnout.
In a traditional agency setting, building an infrastructure of this scale would require a specialized team. You'd need a front-end engineer for the interface, a back-end engineer for the logic, a DevOps specialist for the servers, and a designer.
But Chris executed this solo.
He did. And the structural building block that made this possible, the ultimate solo multiplier, is AI.
Oh, of course.
And we aren't talking about using a chatbot to write a basic Hello World script. AI was integrated as a collaborative partner across the entire technology stack.
Yeah, the documentation reveals he used AI to help build out Amazon Cognito.
Which is huge.
For those unfamiliar, Cognito is essentially Amazon's security bouncer. It handles the complex flow of user sign-ins, managing passwords, and multi-factor authentication. Writing that from scratch is notoriously miserable.
It is the worst.
Right. The AI also helped write the deployment scripts for AWS LightSail, which is the virtual private server hosting the app. It configured the system services, the underlying manager that makes sure the API stays awake and running, and it set up the cron jobs.
Which are basically digital alarm clocks telling the server to run background tasks at specific times.
Exactly. The developer wasn't bogged down in the tedious syntax of server configuration. He was operating at the level of high-level architecture and design intent.
While the AI handled the rote translation of those ideas into functional infrastructure, but what is truly groundbreaking here is that the AI isn't just a tool used during the coding phase.
Oh, right.
The AI is actually alive inside the product itself, actively performing labor.
So let's go back to that core mechanic.
Yeah.
A user takes a photo of a messy, handwritten physical clipboard. How does a digital system turn chicken scratch into a searchable database?
It pings the image to a large language model equipped with vision capabilities.
Oh.
The system hands the photo to the AI and essentially says, hey, read these handwritten names, identify the crossed out lines, determine which dates correspond to which sites, and return that information to me as clean, structured JSON data.
So what does this all mean? It acts as an automated data entry clerk.
Exactly. But it goes even further to enrich the user experience. The official Department of Natural Resources website doesn't tell you if Site 12 is situated right next to a noisy highway or if Site 45 has enough tree cover for decent privacy.
So the system uses AI to ingest massive amounts of public text from across the internet.
Yes. It scans deep Reddit threads, it reads the auto-generated transcripts of YouTube camping vlogs, and it pulls in unstructured reviews from Google Places.
It takes all of that chaotic human chatter and uses the AI to synthesize it into a structured repository of site traits.
Automatically tagging a site for road noise or privacy or river access based on what real people are saying online.
It's doing the work of an entire qualitative research team automatically in the background. That is wild.
And the internal telemetry logs from the source material prove that this isn't just some theoretical prototype. It is a functioning ecosystem.
The numbers back it up.
They do. The system has already successfully processed 41 actual sign-up sheet snapshots taken by campers in the forest, and it has a backlog of over 1,000 queued camper reviews waiting to be synthesized by the AI.
So the AI didn't replace the developer's judgment? It vastly expanded his scope.
Precisely. It allowed one individual to take a highly ambiguous analog piece of paper and create a structured digital mirror. He was playing the roles of designer, engineer, ops manager, and data clerk simultaneously.
When you pull back and look at the aggregate of these decisions, it really challenges so much of accepted industry wisdom.
It totally flips the script.
By ditching the slow-moving mock-up phase, by embracing the messy reality of the woods, and using live code as the prototyping medium.
And by leveraging that clever remote URL mobile shell to bypass the bureaucratic app stores.
Yes, and partnering with AI for both code generation and real-time data processing. Through all of that, a single person built a highly functional, reality-tested application that genuinely solves a problem.
And, crucially, he did it by designing for uncertainty, rather than trying to engineer it out of existence.
Right, he didn't try to build a perfect digital reservation system that would inevitably lie to his users. He built a system that honestly reflects the physical reality of that clipboard, making the uncertainty visible and useful.
If you are listening to this right now, pondering your own product ideas, this should be incredibly empowering.
Totally. The era where you need a specialized team of 10 people, 6 months of venture capital runway, and endless sprint planning meetings just to test if an idea works. That era is rapidly coming to an end.
Thank goodness.
If you are willing to step out of the sandbox, embrace the messy reality of your actual users, and iterate directly in live code, your feedback loops can shrink from months down to hours.
You don't have to guess what the user wants in a vacuum. You just put the tool in their hands and watch them use it.
Exactly. So we're going to leave you with one final thought to mull over today as you look at your own workflows.
Okay.
Think back to that opening image we discussed. Staring at a blank canvas in a design tool, painstakingly drawing boxes to simulate an interface. If AI can now help you build the actual functional working software faster than you can draw a fake wireframe of it.
Does the traditional mock-up phase even need to exist in the future?
Or is it just a comfortable illusion of progress? Something to think about.